Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
This is Money Beat from the Wall Street Journal. Now, from our studios in New York, here are Paul Vigna and Stephen Grosser.
I will tell you, folks, we get a lot of guests in on this podcast, and of course you've heard them all, but it is not every day, well, actually, it is not any day ever, that we have had a Nobel Prize winner on the podcast. I am not kidding you, though. We do have one. Welcome to the Money Beat podcast. I am Paul Vigna. Stephen Grosser has the day off. I am joined, and too bad for Stephen Grosser, I am joined today in the studio by Jean Tirole, who is the chairman of the Toulouse School of Economics and the Institute for Advanced Study in Toulouse, and he is winner of the 2014 Nobel Prize in Economics. He is also the author of the new book, Economics for the Common Good. It will be coming out on November 7th. It is definitely one you want to pick up. Jean, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Paul.
How are you?
Fine. Thanks for having me.
So you came all the way across the ocean for this podcast.
Yes.
As I understand it, right? That's how it was pitched to me.
Yes. So that's the launch now of this book. And it's the first time, actually, I write a wide audience book. It's still a lot of economics and trying to evangelize the economic message. But in the past, I've talked a lot to experts for 25 years. I belong to the French Council of Economic Advisors for 20 years. So talk to the experts in corporations, in ministries and the like, but I never engage with a wider audience. So when I got the Nobel Prize in 2014, I got stopped in the street by people asking me, you know, everything you write is completely unreadable. And you really should write something to explain to us how economics can contribute to the common good.
Okay, so that was the impetus for the book. You know, it's interesting because my job here as a reporter is kind of along the same lines. You know, I'm not an expert in economics. But, I mean, our job is to kind of try to write it that way. So was there a challenge in trying to translate economics for the common good? And should there be a should that challenge really even exist?
Yes, there is a challenge in that we all have cognitive biases, and actually they are very widespread in the population, including very educated people. We believe what we want to believe, and also we stop at first impression. So we see something, we see the direct beneficiaries of a policy, but we forget the indirect and invisible victims of the policy, and we economists are supposed to do that, basically say, watch out. You have this well-meaning policy. It could be rent control. It could be unemployment protection, job protection, or whatever. And say, you're meaning well, but watch out. There are lots of bad consequences of your policy.
I think if you were to walk out onto the street here, walk out onto 6th Avenue, and just spend an hour standing on the corner and asking people what they thought of economics and if they thought economics was working for them, you would probably get a lot of negative answers. Do you think the problem is that people don't understand economics, or do you think the problem is that economics is not understanding people in this day and age?
Well, a little bit of both, honestly, but it's true. I mean, just to give you an anecdote, a French journalist once asked me, is economics for the common good, you know, the title of the book, an oxymoron? And yeah, this is very typical of since the financial crisis in particular, but it's more general than that. If you think experts nowadays are, you know, people are skeptical of experts by and large, and we need to restore trust in experts. It's also true that economists, you know, don't always understand the concerns of people, and we need to do a better job at that. I mean, just take trade, for example. We overwhelmingly are in favor of trade, and we think that free trade is good. At the same time, you know, there are winners and losers. And we don't always qualify our recommendations through watch out. There are losers out there, and those losers are actually may rebel and vote for left-wing or right-wing you know, populist politicians because they are so upset about economics.
And why exactly is that happening at this point? Obviously, that is happening. It's came very close to happening in France, where you had a extreme right-wing leader elected. It did happen here in this country where we've had a man run on a populist message and he was elected. It's happened in other countries. I mean, is economics failing to some point that so many people feel so dissatisfied that they are turning to these other these what before were fringe candidates?
Well, economics is a convenient scapegoat, right? Mm-hmm. And take the financial crisis, which is by and large a huge government failure of failing to regulate what it had to regulate. And, you know, take the European crisis, the same thing. There was no control of public debt of southern European countries, no monitoring of competitiveness. I mean, there was some, but, you know, it was not acted upon. And, you know, in the end, all those failures about, public debt and private debt and also the concern about inequality, the hollowing out of the income distribution, because we have seen, you know, most people wages stagnating with others actually rose very fast. All those things actually fuel concern. And now we, of course, have climate change and this and that. So the populists actually are building on the fears and the frustration. You know, we live in an era where there will be lots of upheaval from the digital revolution. The jobs are going to be destroyed faster and faster. And I know in my home country, people are very worried about that, but it's everywhere the same.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned wages, and I have been banging the drum on wage growth for years and years. And everyone, I'm not trying to toot my own horn a little bit, John. I mean, everyone looks at it now, but I'm telling you, for years, before people were really even looking at it, I was saying, this will not be a healthy economy until you see healthy wage growth. And I don't think we have seen it yet, and I don't think we have a very healthy economy. Why are wages so stagnant? I know the marketplace structure is slightly different in Europe and the United States. I get that, but wages are still very low. Wage growth is still very low. What do you think is driving, or not driving, but what do you think is damping down this wage growth so much?
Well, there are a couple of factors. One is, of course, trade, and which has benefited the nations as a whole, not only China and India, but also France, Europe, the US, UK, and so on. We get richer through trade, but at the same time, those who are in competition with the Chinese, for example, the Indians, of course, suffer because they are substitutes there. Technological progress has the same effect because some jobs are being replaced, and of course, those suffer, especially if similar jobs are not created in the same region. And that's going to get worse and worse. And we know now with AI that actually lots of jobs will be destroyed, not only on skilled jobs, but also skilled jobs. I mean, think just about a general practitioner or doctor. Mm-hmm. Given AI and given genetics, you know, the competition will be very intense very soon.
So where do you, as an economist, as a Nobel Prize winning economist, where do we go from there? I mean, those trends are not going to go away. So how do you compensate for that so that people do have some kind of wage, whether they do maintain a quality of living? Well, I know this is a gigantic question, but I mean, like, what is the answer to that problem?
Well, to be honest, a social scientist, I don't really have an extraordinary answer to that, but there are a few ideas, of course, is that more and more you have to protect workers and not protect jobs. I mean, in Europe, we protect jobs by basically in a number of countries saying that if you want to dismiss a worker, you have to go to a court. And the worker has a right to a court, and that's very expensive. In the U.S., you tend to have more protectionism, at least at the plan. So, protecting job is not going to actually do the job, if I can say so, because by doing that, you won't get job creation anymore. People mm-hmm. The firms won't want to create jobs anymore, so that's going to be a big difficulty. What you have to do is to protect workers, and protection of workers includes generous unemployment benefits, together with, of course, some very strong commitment to take a job if you find one, so there must be very strict monitoring of the unemployed at the same time. Generosity goes with actually monitoring, of course, accountability. You must retrain workers. And, in France, we spend 31 billion euros per year retraining workers without much effect. And, you have to make those structures of retraining much more efficient. you know, better education and the like. I mean, there are a bunch of things like that. And then there is the big issue, which for which we don't have an answer, is universal income.
Because I was going to ask about that. I figured you were going to go there eventually.
Yeah, because universal income, we all have some kind of universal income in most countries, you know, some minimum standard of living. But what's difficult, of course, to calibrate, what can you afford? That's the first question. And the second question is, you want to keep incentive for work because we all have a dignity, right? And we all want to contribute to society. And, you know, there's some, but at the same time, if the wage is really too low, we are not going to make the effort maybe to work. Some people will do, but some people won't. And that's a big challenge. And, you know, we have to calibrate all this, and it's not very easy to do.
Yeah. You know, this is going to sound maybe a little bit weird, but, you know, you talk about, you know, people want to contribute, and of course they do, and they want to be rewarded for their contribution, and that makes sense too. And then sometimes you look at some of the jobs that get rewarded in this country and in other countries elsewhere, you know, sometimes I think the incentives are out of whack. When I see people who contribute, really frankly, let's not kid ourselves, very little, making very much, and people who I think contribute quite a lot, making not quite so much, and I'm thinking firefighters, policemen, teachers, nurses, who do not get paid very well. And then you look at, say, entertainers who get paid millions and tens of millions. And, you know, I like television and movies and sports also. But, I mean, if you just look at the pay scales, our incentives seem so out of – jobs that are very, very valuable do not get paid very much. And jobs that really are not necessary at all get paid millions and millions. What's the economic incentive structure there? How are these things ending up like this?
Well, in a sense, I mean, it's supply and demand as usual.
Yeah.
And, you know, the superstar economy that you find not only in entertainment but in many other professions, actually. So those superstars, and that's a big challenge, you know, you have two ways. They can contribute to society by giving, and some of them do that in the U.S., of course. The other way is, of course, to have some kind of, you know, income taxation, which is progressive enough without destroying incentive to work, of course, but which is progressive enough. And that's important. It's hard to do, actually, because, you know, you want to reward merit, of course, and people who have, for example, created a job and lots of, you know, a firm and lots of jobs for others. You want to reward them. But at the same time, those people now,
they get rewarded.
They get
Somehow I think they get rewarded.
They get rewarded very heavily. And,
and they deserve it. They earn it. I'm not
they
saying
earn
they
it.
Don't.
Yeah, no, that's right. The issue is really now international, because if you think about people who create Google or a new biotech company and so on, there are few people, highly talented and hardworking people, to be sure, but they are completely mobile, so they can actually play one country against another. And, you know, people are going to move where, of course, where the best universities will be and so on. And that's actually where America is very strong. But at the same time, also the ones which have the lowest taxes. And to some extent, you know, this fiscal competition, you know, we don't know how to solve it. And it's very hard because different countries want to have different tax rates. It's a choice of society. And economists don't have much to say about that. They can say a tax structure is inefficient, but, you know, decided how redistributive a society should be is something that is a choice of society, not the choice of the economist. And so the question is, how do you make sure that there is limited, reasonable tax competition among countries? But as long as there is that kind of competition, it's very hard actually to redistribute, because my view is that, you know, you don't. We don't have to decide whether a banker is less deserving than a football player or whatever. You know, this will be ridiculous. I mean, the question is, there could be some income redistribution through income tax, and that's what we have got to do. You know, destroy all the loopholes and just make sure that people pay their fair taxes.
Mm. All right. That's a strong statement. I like it. We are speaking with economic prize winner, Nobel Prize winner, Jean Tirole. This is Money Beat from the Wall Street Journal.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
For a new podcast experience, subscribe to the Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal.
Now on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.
Welcome back to Money Beat. Paul Vigna here in the studio. Stephen Grosser is off today. We are speaking with Nobel Prize winning economist Jean Tirole. Jean, welcome back.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.
All right. So this is good. I enjoyed our first segment. I think we cleared our throats a little bit there. Now we can kind of dig in, get a little deeper. My job here now these days is covering Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrencies, that whole kind of world. That's my beat now. And I think it's interesting, not just in what it says about Bitcoin and the idea of a rebel money and all that, but I mean, beyond that, I think there's a big, large question about economics, not economics, but about technology and even in market structures utilizing technology, racing ahead of where we are in terms of economic theory. And it seems like to me that a lot of what is going on in the real world is far ahead of where we are in terms of understanding how to manage it. And where do you stand on that? What do you think is going on in the world right now? Is economics keeping up with what's happening in the real world?
I think you are right, Paul. Economics is, we try to keep up with what's happening to anticipate the new challenges. So we have been working in particular in Toulouse, but all over the world on platform economics, so two-sided markets where you try to attract the two sides of markets, the buyer and sellers. And the top five market caps in the world actually are two-sided markets. Alphabet and Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, and so on. So it's a new economy, and we try to both work on the business model and how do you structure. So you mentioned Bitcoin. If Bitcoin wants to enter the market for, to compete with credit cards, for example, debit cards, it has to use a different structure of payments between buyers and sellers than it does now. That's one thing. But we also think about regulation. So, for example, nowadays, antitrust authorities quote two-sided markets when in their arguments, and they cite that heavily, but they don't always apply the recommendation that you should take the two sides into account at the same time when you analyze market power and not one side in isolation, because often the pricing structure are very unbalanced. They are skewed. If you use Google, for example, you get all those great free services, so it's like a negative price in a sense, but of course there is no miracle, and the advertisers are going to pay a lot.
Right.
And that's true for most two-sided markets. But we have to anticipate much more, the implication of AI, the implication of cryptocurrencies and all those things, and how we are going to deal with those markets which are more and more concentrated. You see more and more of, the markups have gone up. The investment costs are very big, but then also the markups have been increasing in most industries and not only in biotechnologies and IT. But
It seems like it's funny because you talked about companies going where the tax structure is the best, and you talk about markets sort of getting ahead of regulations. It seems like we're at a point where if you understand what is going on in this world, that you do have a larger advantage than in the past. I mean, regulators in different countries are trying to come to grips with what's going on, and they're not very well coordinated. But companies, you look at companies just in terms of taxes, they have been arbitraging tax structures for years. They've gotten this. They've gotten the global supply chain. They've gotten how they can kind of take the biggest advantage of the marketplace. How do regulators get a grip on all this?
On taxes, and I'm not an expert on taxes, but it's
nobody clear. Really is these days, actually, when you think about it.
It's pretty clear that with transfer pricing, it has been going on for centuries, but now, of course, with intellectual property, it's very easy to locate the money-making division in some tax haven, of course, and then it gets all the revenues. And of course, it's parked in Bermudas, for example, so it's not even clear that the U.S. benefits from that. There, it's just like with climate change, with fiscal competition, the only way is international coordination. So I'm very concerned. We have to keep talking internationally so as to find agreements, and under the previous administration, some were found, for example, with some tax havens. We need to cooperate. I mean, the issue is not to say, you know, here's the right tax rate or something, but there is some minimum cooperation which has to be in place.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because on the one hand, I think it's very self-evident that that is the case, that we live in a global economy. We have a global marketplace. But as soon as you start talking about that, you will hear it from the skeptics who will start talking about the black helicopters and the global world order and some dystopian, horrible world government. Where does that kind of coordination happen? Is it within, say, an institution like the UN? Is it outside of it? I mean, where do you see it happening? And where are you trying to encourage it to happen?
Well, it's a geopolitical issue. And, you know, I'm an economist, but I try to think about those things. So, for example, I have a chapter on climate change. And one of the things that strikes me is, you know, that with the COP21 in Paris, which was the agreement 2 years ago about climate change, you look at the agreement, there was very little in the agreement, you know, in a sense, nothing binding, no binding pledges, mm-hmm. some collective pledge to give to poor countries, but it was a collective pledge. I mean, there was nothing rebinding. But if you look at it, you know, the negotiator's intent was to get the 196 countries on board. So if you have Venezuela or Saudi Arabia on board, you are already sure that there won't be anything in the agreement because, of course, they don't want any carbon price.
Right.
And that's a difficulty. In the end, and I may be wrong, I think you also know that you need the biggest countries, in the case of climate change, that will be the biggest emitters, to get together and say, hey, we cannot go on like this. We need to do something, and let's at least agree among ourselves, which is not easy. I mean, it's difficult. But let's agree among ourselves to actually do something, and let's put pressure, you know, maybe through the WTO, maybe through other things. Nothing is easy in that matter, but, you know, trying to agree to a new world order in some sense, because if everybody has a veto, nothing is going to happen.
Yeah. All right. I don't know how much time you have, but I want to keep going for a few more minutes at least. I'm going to ask three more questions at least. I want you to give me, if you would, and I'll ask them all three questions in one because it's basically the same question from three different angles. If you could tell me one thing that economists could do to help the economy work better for the common good, one thing, say, regulators and politicians could do to help the economy work more for the common good, and one thing people, like those people out on Sixth Avenue that we were talking about, one thing they should do for themselves to help both themselves and maybe for the work for the common good.
Well, many questions here.
Yeah.
I don't know. About politicians, I would like to say something. I talk a lot about politicians in the book because, of course, as an economist over the years, I got frustrated by seeing what kind of economic policy are implemented. And even so, I was giving a lot of advice, and lots of my fellow economists were giving advice. But blaming economists, blaming politicians, I'm sorry, is not going to lead anywhere. Mm-hmm. Because we have to realize politicians are like you and me and everybody else. We react to our own incentives. So if you are a politician, of course, you think about re-election,
mm-hmm.
and which means that you are going to have short-term-oriented policies. We economists have to think about the long term more. But this short-term orientation is very damaging. So are the cognitive biases, of course. You know, as mentioned earlier, that we, for good reasons, actually, we believe what we want to believe. We want to think that the future will be bright and we don't have to put any effort to reduce the debt or fund the pensions or fight climate change or whatever. And, you know, this, by the way, this is promoted by both climate skeptics and by green growth, you know, people, because they think that it's not going to cost anything to fight climate mm-hmm. change. It's the same idea in a sense, even so they come from very opposite side of the political spectrum. So the politicians are always, you know, they are good politicians and bad politicians. They are courageous people and not courageous people, but by and large, they will tend to be short-termist mm-hmm. because they need to be reelected, and that's the issue. And, you know, just blaming them is no good for democracy. At some point, we have to realize that there are incentives. So one of the things is that we have to resist the siren calls of the primacy of politics. So, you know, there are many attacks, for example, on independent central banks, and people don't realize that actually independent central banks is a way, you know, we succeeded in getting rid of inflation, you know, 30 years ago or 35 years ago. Same thing, you know, with powerful prudential supervision, of course, we may reduce the risk of financial crisis. And I will say the same thing with competition policy and the like. And they are not perfect. They don't have always the perfect experts and so on. But they do a better job on average because they are independent, so they can more easily apply economic reasoning as opposed to being pressured by the lobbies. So we have to restructure. We have to restructure government and keep it well organized, provide incentives. You know, I say the market often fails, but the government fails as often as well. And you know, the market needs regulation, but the government needs incentives, and we don't have them.
How do we do that? It seems like there's kind of a monopoly hold on power in government. I mean, how do you restructure the incentives to get those better outcomes?
Well, here is an issue.
I know that's a huge question.
It's a huge question, and what I'm worrying is basically is experts are more and more dismissed, and you know, sometimes for good reasons. But you know, by and large, an economy without society without experts is extremely dangerous because anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in most fields, there is a consensus at any point of time. And, you know, this consensus can change over time because we learn, but, you know, there is a consensus that we should do this, this, and that. And it's true in medicine, in climate science, in economics, and many other fields that are close to the public. And if we don't have this respect for experts, then it makes it into a very difficult situation. And, you know, we see that more and more. I see in England, for example, with Brexit, some of the Brexit advocates actually say, I don't want to talk to experts. I want to talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with Marine Le Pen with the National Front in France. She's always said, you know, I don't talk to experts. I talk to the people. And, you know, this is very symptomatic of what's going on. And if we don't have any respect for the experts, then, you know, the democracy is in big danger. Now, it's a long-term thing, but I think we should teach in high school the scientific method, for example, so that any pupil in high school, it's not that hard actually to teach it at a low level. You know, just small experiments to know how you do a control group and a treatment group. When you do an experiment, you do it in medicine, you do it in economics, in other things. You know, just to understand how you can test something, just that, how do you build a theory, whatever.
Well, and just basic logic.
Basic logic, yeah. So, for democracy, we need to actually have at least some respect for the experts.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to teach in school.
So you're getting back to education.
Yes.
So education is a huge part of this.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So much to talk about. All right. We could probably talk for another hour, but I'm sure you have a lot more to do. Jean Tirole is author of Economics for the Common Good, 2014 Nobel Prize winner in economics. We're so lucky to have you in today. I really appreciate this. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Paul. I really appreciate that as well.
And everyone, I hope you got a lot out of it. I'm sure you got a lot out of it. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you soon.